the largest prisoner swap between the U.S. and Russia since the end of the Cold War.
Today was a very good day. And we're going to build on it, drawing inspiration and continued courage from it for all of those who are held hostage or wrongfully detained around the world.
At least three protesters are killed in Nigeria.
We are tired of being hungry. We cannot even feed our children.
And if you don't like pulling weeds, have I got a robot for you.
Nobody really wants to go through a field weeding on a really wet, windy, cold day. So why not give it to a robot? So the best way of describing it is a schoolboy with a magnifying glass.
Today is Friday, August 2nd.
And this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Scott Walterman.
And I'm Alexis Strope.
Today we're bringing on Paul, Evan, also Vladimir.
The United States and Russia have completed a 24-person prisoner swap, the largest in post-Soviet history, with Moscow releasing journalist Evan Gershkovich and fellow American Paul Whelan in a multinational deal that set 24 people free. The swap involved 16 political prisoners exchanged for 8 individuals requested by the Kremlin. More now from Reuters correspondent Zachary Goldman.
A massive multinational prisoner swap on Thursday saw the release of 24 people, including Americans held in Russian jails.
And now, their brutal ordeal is over, and they're free.
U.S. President Joe Biden said the released include Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich, former U.S. Marine Paul Whelan, Russian-American journalist Alsu Kurmasheva, and Vladimir Karamurza, a British-Russian activist.
The deal that made this possible was a feat of diplomacy and friendship.
The exchange was coordinated by Turkey, and this Russian government jet was seen at the airport in Ankara on Thursday. The White House said the U.S. had negotiated the complex trade with Russia and other countries.
This deal would not have been made possible without our allies. Germany, Poland, Slovenia, Norway, and Turkey, they all stepped up, and they stood with us. They stood with us. And they made bold and brave decisions. Released prisoners being held in their countries who are justifiably being held.
8 prisoners held in the West were part of the swap. Germany confirmed they include Vadim Krasikov. Krasikov is a colonel in the Russian FSB security service who was serving a life sentence in Germany for murdering an exiled dissident in a Berlin park. Russian President Vladimir Putin had indicated he wanted him back. Germany's government said releasing Krasikov was not an easy decision.
What's remarkable about this prisoner swap is the scope and the scale.
Timothy Fry is a professor at Columbia University and the author of a book about Putin's Russia.
Certainly, I think it's a big win for the Biden administration. Of course, one always has to be worried that exchanging political prisoners for criminals will only encourage rogue states, not only Russia, but other states as well, from taking innocent foreigners as hostages and using them as bargaining chips.
The Kremlin said the prisoners released by the swap were pardoned by Putin decrees and that the move was aimed at returning Russian captives held abroad.
Reuters correspondent Zachary Goldman.
16 people released from Russian jails in exchange for 8 people Russia wanted back from the West. What is the game, the goal in all of this on Russia's part? To help us understand why these people were arrested in Russia and why they were released, joining us is Sergei Sanovich, a fellow at the Hoover Institution, Stanford University. What do you think we're looking at from a strategic standpoint on the Russian side of this swap?
Think about the people who are who Russia exchanged, a foreign journalist, right? And intimidating foreign journalists is an important part of Russian information control strategy. It doesn't only involve abducting, like in the case of Evan Gershkovich, but also expelling people, harassing, surveilling, and all sorts of other problems that foreign journalists, you know, people, you know, leave for a, you know, for a holiday back home, and then they denied entry or denied visa and so forth. Organizations, now I think even foreign organizations are being declared foreign agents, undesirable organizations, and so forth. So that is a part of a system that allows Kremlin to operate out of the limelight and do their dirty business in darkness. Second, political prisoners. They were arrested to make sure that nobody in Russia who is against Putin and against the war, and again, these people exist, even according to some official polling data, it's millions of people, maybe tens of millions, to keep them quiet. Some are facing really harsh punishments, like people in this case who were serving 25-year prison sentences and so forth. So that is, you know, an important function here. And one important thing I want to note is that it's not unheard of, even in Putin's Russia, for people to get released. It could be an amnesty. Imagine Putin decides that he wants to stop a war in Ukraine, declares victory, and there is an amnesty attached to that, or this kind of prisoner exchange, right? But what never once happened in Putin's Russia is that any of the quickly growing set of laws that these people violated was ever repealed. So all these laws about, you know, disagreeing with the Russian government, describing the war in terms different from the official, Ministry of Defense spokesperson, all these laws will remain on the books, meaning that other people will fill these empty cells.
So you're saying that this is how they send a message to journalists and citizens who, I don't know, might disagree with the government, you know, to watch themselves?
Yes. So when it comes to people who are doing any kind of opposition activity or even human rights monitoring, just helping, you know, people, whether it's refugees from Ukraine or LGBT people or whoever, right, intimidating them is a goal of its own. This exchange will not get rid of the stain that Putin created on Russian reputation, because Evan Gershkovich, again, he was born to refugees from USSR in Princeton, United States, and he learned Russian, he went to Russia, and he even invited his parents to visit to see that country is different from what they remember from 1970s. And the next time they visited him in a cell in the fort of a KGB prison. Not every country gets such a great coverage that Evan Gershkovich was providing to Russia, really going places, talking to people, understanding the country. He loved Russia. And this is the kind of treatment he got.
There weren't only foreigners in this exchange. There were Russian citizens, too. Talk about that for us.
You know, the fact that Russia was ready to exchange its own citizens, it's sort of bizarre in a way. And I think it's also part of the Kremlin strategy. They always wanted to say that domestic opposition is not really Russian politicians or journalists or thinkers. This is planted. This is CIA at work. These people get directions and money from, U.S. embassy. And this exchange, which for many of these people is truly life-saving, because, you know, Sasha Skalichenko, for instance, who was doing a peaceful protest against the war, she had particular conditions that required a certain diet. And, of course, in prison, it was not available. Ilya Yashin, he spent, months on end in solitary confinement with rats and rotten food and, you know, without heat in winter or air conditioning in summer. It's really brutal. And remember what happened with Alexei Navalny. Putin, of course, will use it to portray them as really not Russian, but of United States or Britain, like in Vladimir Karamurza case. So I think we should all be grateful for German leaders, American leaders, who thought not only about their citizens, but about other people who are fighting for democracy and peace in Russia. But you know, at the same time, we also need to realize how problematic this is, that, you know, Putin continues to get his demands met.
Sergei Sanovich, a fellow at the Hoover Institution, Stanford University.
Following the assassination of a Hezbollah leader in Beirut and a Hamas leader in Tehran this week, Israel announced it had killed the head of Hamas's military wing, Mohammed Deif, last month. Details now from Reuters correspondent Sean Hogan.
The IDF announcing on Thursday an intelligence assessment confirmed his death when their fighter jets struck the site in Khan Yunis on July 13th. Deif is believed to have been one of the masterminds of Hamas's October 7th attack on southern Israel, which triggered the Gaza War. One of Hamas's most dominant figures and top of Israel's most wanted list for decades, Deif rose through the group's ranks over 30 years, developing its network of tunnels and its bomb-making expertise. Hamas neither confirmed nor denied his death, but one official said any word on deaths of its leaders was its responsibility alone. Scores of Palestinians were killed in airstrikes that killed Deif, medics in Gaza say. The announcement came as crowds gathered in Tehran for the funeral procession of Hamas's leader Ismail Haniyeh. Haniyeh was assassinated in the Iranian capital, with both Iran and Hamas blaming Israel, which hasn't denied or confirmed a role in his killing. Hezbollah and Hamas are backed by Iran. These latest killings have raised concern of a future escalation in hostilities in the Middle East. Israel has said it does not seek regional war, but that it would respond forcefully to any attack. And now, on the 300th day of warfare in Gaza, hopes for a hostage deal and ceasefire have dimmed.
That was Reuters correspondent Sean Hogan.
At least three protesters were killed in Nigeria on Thursday. We get the latest now from Reuters correspondent Alice Rizzo.
Police fired tear gas to disperse crowds of protesters in Nigeria's capital, Abuja, on Thursday, as thousands rallied across several cities over an escalating cost of living and governance issues. Reuters video showed people marching across Africa's most populous nation to show discontent with economic reforms that have led to rampant inflation and inflicted increasing hardship on ordinary Nigerians. In Lagos, armed police watched as protesters marched towards the government house before heading to two locations that were authorized for the protests. Some shopping malls in the city were shut and guarded by a heavy police presence.
We are tired of being hungry. We cannot even feed our children.
Consumer inflation in Nigeria rose to a new 28-year high of 34.19% in annual terms in June. As well as soaring inflation, Nigerians are also grappling with widespread insecurity, which damaged the farming sector, while armed gangs kidnap residents and school children for ransom in the north. President Bola Tinubu has asked citizens to bear with his reforms and has vowed to pursue changes he says are needed to keep the country afloat. He signed a new minimum wage into law on Monday to help workers cope with hardship caused by his economic changes. But many of the country's 200 million people are either self-employed or do not have jobs.
Reuters correspondent Alice Rizzo.
We're following these other stories from around the world. The United States has recognized Edmundo Gonzalez Urrutia as the winner of the Venezuelan election. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said it is clear to the United States and, most importantly, to the Venezuelan people that Gonzalez won.
African health officials say Mpox cases have surged by 160% so far this year, warning that the risk of further spread is high given the lack of treatments or vaccines on the continent.
Former Presidents Barack Obama and George W. Bush will join an effort to commemorate America's 250th anniversary in 2026. They're highlighting the initiative's attempts to build bipartisan momentum in an era of extreme political polarization.
In our continuing coverage of the 2024 U.S. presidential election, Republican candidate Donald Trump and likely Democratic candidate Kamala Harris are both out on the campaign trail, where Trump questioned Harris's racial identity and Harris challenged Trump to debate. With fewer than 100 days before the election, VOA correspondent Scott Stearns looks at the state of the race and what voters are saying about the candidates.
Republican candidate Donald Trump told supporters in the key swing state of Pennsylvania that his likely Democratic opponent is a fraud.
The radical left Democrat Party bosses have installed a puppet candidate to fight only for themselves. Kamala Harris got zero votes. She's totally scripted, owned, and controlled by the donors and the power brokers who created her campaign and who rip off our government and make billions and billions of dollars.
Former President Donald Trump.
Earlier in the day, Trump had a contentious meeting with black journalists where he questioned the racial identity of Harris, whose mother was Indian and her father is black.
She was always of Indian heritage, and she was only promoting Indian heritage. I didn't know she was black until a number of years ago when she happened to turn black, and now she wants to be known as black. So I don't know, is she Indian or is she black?
Harris has long self-identified as both black and South Asian American. Since becoming the likely Democratic presidential candidate, she's drawn even with Trump in seven key swing states. According to political polling by Bloomberg News and The Morning Consult, largely on the strength of greater support from young, black, and Hispanic voters.
So the momentum in this race is shifting. And there are signs that Donald Trump is feeling it. You may have noticed.
Harris told a rally Tuesday in Georgia that Trump seems to have a lot to say about her, but does not want to debate in September as scheduled.
Well, Donald, you'll reconsider to meet me on the debate stage. Because as the saying goes, if you've got something to say, say it to my face.
Harris is expected to announce her vice presidential pick in the coming days and still has the party's convention in Chicago to help convince voters that she's a better choice than Trump. In North Carolina, voter Wanda Cherry says she's excited about the Democratic Party switch from President Joe Biden
and
to Harris.
I'm glad that the president realized that we need somebody younger to run the country, somebody that has the smarts and the willingness to run.
Georgia voter T. Stanley does not believe Harris is ready to be president.
First, her being the candidate is like horrific to me because, first of all, she's not prepared to be president, and it seems like she's already president now.
Georgia voter Phil Ownby says Harris has reinvigorated the presidential race.
I will vote for her, and I'm excited to do so. I generally think she may be a little liberal on certain issues, but in order to safeguard our democracy, I definitely vote for her.
In California, voter Marina George says Trump's support is strong enough to defeat any challenger.
Even with Kamala Harris coming in, anyone they put, they're not going to win. It's just making the Democrat Party break apart even more and faster. And everything that they're doing is good for the Republicans.
Nationally, the Bloomberg poll shows Harris and Trump in a statistical tie with fewer than 100 days to go before Election Day. Scott Stearns, VOA News.
China is expanding its imports of semi-processed agricultural products from Africa in an effort to address a trade imbalance and also as a way of diversifying global food chains amid geopolitical tensions. Kate Bartlett visits South Africa's rural Limpopo province, where avocado farmers are getting ready to export their products to the Chinese market for the first time.
Derek Duncan is the CEO of a South African Fruit Growers Association and has been working with Chinese inspectors to open so-called green lanes to get avocado exports off the ground. China has long been the African continent's biggest trade partner, but the Asian giant exports some $60 billion more in goods to Africa each year than it imports. In South Africa's case, China exported $11 billion more than it imported in 2022, the most recent year for which figures are available.
Because there's been a strong impetus from the Chinese as well to make sure that this deal happens, because they're aware of that trade imbalance and that they need to be taking more exports from South Africa.
The avocado deal with Beijing was made last year when South Africa hosted Chinese President Xi Jinping on a state visit alongside the summit of the BRICS Group of Emerging Economies. At the time, South Africa urged China to address the trade deficit. Lauren Johnston is an associate professor of China studies at the University of Sydney.
Another kind of bigger geostrategic reason for the push on food exports is similar to kind of diversify the global agricultural supply chain. You know, you've had this pressure on China. You've got the soybean pressure from the US. You've got different pressures and trade tensions between Australia and China.
As part of its agricultural push in Africa, China also imports soybeans, citrus, wine, and rooibos tea from South Africa, avocados and tea from Kenya, and coffee from Rwanda and Ethiopia. China's new ambassador to South Africa, Wu Peng, has promised measures are being taken to speed up the export of more agricultural products to China. The potential of this is huge, says Clive Garrett, marketing manager for ZZ2, a South African farming conglomerate which will soon be exporting its avocados to China.
Until October in 2023, South Africa really could only export to Europe, a little bit to the Middle East. But now, since then, we've had Japan, China, and India open to us. And these are very exciting markets because the per capita consumption in these markets is still incredibly low. So we see huge opportunities of going into these markets.
According to industry estimates, there are some 300 million people in China earning enough to buy imported fruit. That can only be good news for farmers and workers here in this bucolic mountain town. Kate Bartlett, VOA News, Zanine, Limpopo, South Africa.
VOA's International Edition continues.
I'm Alexis Strope.
And I'm Scott Walterman. Turbulence is knocking a beloved instant noodle offering off of Korean Air's economy menu. Cups of Shin Ramyun instant noodles have become a favorite among Korean Air travelers over the years, but a spokesperson for the Seoul-based airline says they will no longer be available for economy class passengers starting August 15th.
Wheeling up and down a field, a farming robot dubbed Claws uses patented concentrated light technology to eliminate weeds without damaging the surrounding crops or soil. The approach is not only effective, but also sustainable, according to Earth Rover CEO James Miller. Reuters correspondent Arthi Thayaparan has more.
CLAWS stands for Concentrated Light Autonomous Weeding and Scouting. The robot was designed by Earth Rover. James Miller is the CEO of the agriculture tech startup.
So the best way of describing it is a schoolboy with a magnifying glass. So it concentrates the light onto a small focal point on the meristem, the growing point of the weed, and delivers a small pulse of energy, which is enough to kill the weed. It takes an individual photograph and assesses the crop beneath it, identifies the crop, protects that, and then identifies the weeds around it and says, they're enemy, I'm targeting those. And that all happens in a split second and starts shooting at the weeds.
Miller says this method is more sustainable by reducing greenhouse gas emissions that could be released during soil disturbance. To help monitor crop health, Claws is equipped with 8 built-in cameras. It collects real-time data using AI computer vision, which is then sent to Earth Rover's Farm Control and Intelligence System. The information allows farmers to make timely decisions about the health and growth of the crop. Claws runs on battery and solar power and operates autonomously in different terrains and weather conditions. Earth Rover has plans to deliver units to customers for testing in 2025. Commercial availability is slated for 2026.
That was Reuters correspondent Arthi Thayaparan. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America.
On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you so much for spending this time with us.
For pictures, videos, stories, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com.
In Washington, with Alexis Strope, I'm Scott Walterman.